SaaS Backwards is sponsored by Austin Lawrence Group, specializing in demand gen for SaaS. It sure is noisy. I deleted 100 emails from vendors just this morning. Your buyer has gotten better at ignoring you, and you're gonna need a big idea if you want to cut through all that clutter. Austin Lawrence is just the right agency to help you find it. So if your campaigns are falling on deaf eyeballs, let's talk. Visit austinlawrence.com today, and let's build something bigger.
Welcome to the SaaS Backwards Podcast, where we reverse engineer the success of fast-growing SaaS firms and explore strategies CMOs and CEOs are using to drive their businesses forward.
Welcome to SaaS Backwards, a podcast that helps SaaS CMOs and CEOs to accelerate growth and enhance profitability. Our guest today is Harsha Rajasimha, founder and CEO of Jiva Informatics, a human-centric software-as-a-service platform enabling clinical research at scale. Harsha, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me, Cam.
Hey, it's a pleasure, and I'm really interested in your story and the company, so why don't we go right at it and tell us a little bit more about yourself and why and how you founded Jiva.
Thank you, Ken. It's been an interesting journey. My background is in genomics and data science in the precision medicine space. I grew up learning about the human genome sequence data and analysis right from when the first human genome was sequenced in the year 2000. That's when I got involved, coming from a computer science engineering major into the computational biology interdisciplinary PhD program at Virginia Tech. After 7 years of grad school and analyzing microbial genomes, I moved to National Institutes of Health, looking at cancer research and ophthalmology, retinal diseases. And I was already involved in, you know, mutation genetic expedition, looking for disease-causing mutations. So that was my academic and professional background until 2012, when we had numerous publications as a co-author, as a major author, publishing in Nature, American Journal of Human Genetics, and so on. And I was loving every day of my scientific job. In 2012, it became personal. You know, when I and my wife had a child born with a rare congenital disorder called Edwards syndrome. And then I got exposed to what patients and families experience and go through in this, particularly in rare disease space, when, you know, where 93% of rare diseases do not have any approved treatment options. And there's over 10,800 known rare diseases. So I became a patient advocate, got involved in the community that the National Institutes of Health has a dedicated office for rare disease research since the 1980s. And the FDA had a Orphan Drug Act signed into law since 1983. And learning about the phenomenal progress that had occurred in the United States back when there were a small number of orphan drugs in 1983 to now where there is more than 1,100 approved orphan drugs for treating these small populations of people affected by individual rare diseases.
Now, did you call those orphan drugs?
That is correct.
What does that mean, actually?
Yeah, any drug that is used to treat medical condition that affects fewer than 200,000 Americans is defined as an orphan drug in the United States. And every country, or at least some of the countries, have developed their own national definition based on the prevalence and incidence of a disease. For example, sickle cell disease is rare in the United States, but it's quite common in the Middle East or Africa. And there are many such examples, but that's what an orphan drug is. And so the economics are quite skewed, you know, against these pharmaceutical companies that make orphan drugs. And there are also numerous common indications like diabetes, which affected my younger brother in his teenage years and battled with it with his lifestyle for 16 years before he passed away in his 30s, very suddenly got into renal dialysis. And, you know, in a span of 9 months, health deteriorated significantly and he passed away. That was in 2017. Mm. And that's when I turned into an entrepreneur founding Jiva. Before that, I was still involved in launching genetic testing for rare disease and cancer, sort of speeding up this diagnostic odyssey that is still averages about 5 to 7 years in the United States and Europe, and much longer in countries like India and other countries. And so coming from healthcare life science consulting for 4 years with Dell Services and NTT Data Services, in 2018, I decided to start Jiva to speed up access to clinical trials for people living anywhere in the country or the world, as 80% of clinical trial participants historically over the last 70, 80 years have been Caucasian male adults from affluent socioeconomic backgrounds, resulting in a significant lack of diversity and inclusion in clinical research. That became very evident, you know, during the pandemic. But when I founded Jiva, it was a bit of a still early days for remote patient engagement, remote patient monitoring, and significantly accelerated during the pandemic. And so that's the space where my mission is really with Jiva, to enable access to clinical trials for people irrespective of their geographic location globally.
So if I understand correctly, then a lot of these trials would occur near the physical infrastructure of the clinical labs, right? So the research organizations would recruit from their own backyards more than across the country or elsewhere.
That's exactly how it was happening since the 1950s, when the randomized controlled clinical trial paradigm began, which is really the gold standard. You know, these are largely restricted to academic medical centers in Boston, Houston, Chicago, Bethesda, and so on. And so the opportunity to access innovation of these investigational new medicines or drugs and treatment options was really limited to approximately 50-mile radius of these hotspots within the United States and Europe, where majority of the clinical trials are executed, because this is where the research funding is for biomedical research, and this is where the industry investments happen for biotechnology and pharma. And that had to change, because that was only reaching less than 2% of the target population. So if we can go out and cast the net wide on the internet, and if we can find patients living away from these hotspots, then we are now increasing the outreach to 60 to 80% of the population who have access to stable internet and are available or findable on the internet.
So these randomized controlled trials were maybe not quite as random, right? If they were not more reflective of the population. For us lay people, it's the same thing as sampling error in polling, right? Where if you're only asking a certain population of people, you're only going to get a certain result. And here, if you're only testing a predominantly white affluent male population, you could miss the implications for a large number of the patients that you're trying to help ultimately, right?
Guidelines. Until recently, everyone agreed, but there were neither carrots nor sticks for achieving diversity. And the goal of a pharma company is to get a new drug to market faster in a cost-effective manner, but it's highly inefficient process and a long and complex process, because 9 out of 10 candidate drugs that get into clinical development fail during the clinical trial process, either due to safety concerns or due to drug efficacy concerns. And so it's a highly risky business, you know, 9 out of 10 odds of failing for every drug, and it can cost hundreds of millions of dollars to execute one clinical trial. And so the overall cost of getting one successful drug to market had exceeded $2.5 billion because of this high failure rates. And that was really striking to me, because I thought the significant opportunity to make this process more efficient and streamlined. That's why I founded Jiva.
Great. So let's get to the problem. I want you to just sort of reiterate, because I think we took a little bit of a random walk here. Let's just reiterate the problem you're trying to solve with Jiva Informatics and how you arrived at that problem, because I think it took you a little bit to get there yourself.
Absolutely. You know, 5 years ago, the problem that I identified, which was it cost $2.5 billion to bring one successful therapy to market to patients. And two, it takes 10 to 12 years from when a drug candidate is discovered in the laboratory to when it gets to the patients through the regulatory process. And so we had a significant problem, because this was getting worse and worse year after year and not getting better. That was the problem. Now, when I founded Jiva, we went out as a team to do customer discovery. And we went out and asked customers, why is this the case? Why does it take so long and cost so much money? Where are the barriers and bottlenecks? And we heard very interesting things, you know, many aha moments. And we followed this almost for 14 months before we actually started building the product. And today, we have interviewed over 3,000 stakeholders of clinical trials, which includes the biopharmaceutical sponsors, CROs or contract research organizations, investigators and sites, and patients and families that participate in clinical trials who volunteer to be part of the clinical trials. So what we heard is, number one, patient recruitment is the biggest barrier, as most clinical trials are delayed in their process of finding and recruiting the eligible patients into a clinical trial. And part of that is site selection or investigator sites. Like I mentioned, Boston, Bay Area, Houston versus somewhere else, if you want to cover the diversity and good science to make sure the target population is represented, you got to select the right investigator sites, you know, especially when most visits to the by the patients has to be in person. And then once they get past the patient recruitment from the right sites within in a timely manner, then it's a matter of keeping those patients interested and engaged so they complete the clinical trial, which can span 18 months to several years. And how do we keep patients engaged? There might be burden of travel and the frequency of travel. And so we heard several problems like this. And then we started peeling the layers of the onions. You know, why is patient recruitment a problem? Why is patient retention a problem? And then we started hearing additional details, you know, of the data quality, data completeness, ultimately, which is what the FDA will review in deciding whether the drug is safe and effective in the target population. And so in that, how can technology be leveraged and whether the industry was utilizing the digital innovation that was very much being used in other industries, but not so much in the pharma industry. And so that was the problem.
But was it actually, you used a great expression, the hair on fire problem. Mm-hmm. And by the way, that's really impressive. A few thousand interviews is quite a effort to mount. And it's interesting. I think some of the more successful software founders we've interviewed on the podcast have done some kind of process like this. They've taken their own experience and sought to validate it through that kind of research. So I think that's great that you did it. But what was the hair on fire problem in all of that?
Yeah, exactly. It was patient recruitment. You know, that's the gorilla in the room. And there is the problem is very well known across the industry. And there are many reasons for that. Like I mentioned, some of them, which is the location of where the clinical trial sites are located, the frequency of visits, the complexity of the study. And then from the patient perspective, there are various reasons why they may not choose to enroll even when they are eligible. And even when they are informed about a clinical trial, they have fear of side effects, fear of being a placebo and not receiving the treatment, which we cannot really address. You know, ultimately, the patient has to make a decision on whether they want to enroll in a trial or not. But some proportion of the patients who choose not to enroll. Now, the other proportion of patients who actually can be addressed if the reason for not enrolling is the travel and logistical burden. You know, if they say, you know, if there's only two visits to Boston in a year, I am willing to travel, you know, and if I can participate from my home on my smartphone on a telemedicine visit or share data by uploading files or sharing my opinion and the outcomes, patients are more willing to participate when the studies are patient-centric. And so what we discovered is the challenges were human in nature, not so much technology, but really human problems. And that's why we call our platform human-centric, because we used empathy to feel the pain of each stakeholders that we interviewed and built a platform that addresses their objections, barriers, obstacles to why they would or not enroll in a trial from a patient side. And from a clinical trial operator side, there are numerous actors, you know, like the data manager, investigator, coordinator, research associate, etc. Each one have to perform different functions and they all have to collaborate to make one study successful. And so there is a heavy dependency on study manager who makes these collaborations effective in a clinical trial. And we wanted to decrease the dependency on one human playing a pivotal role in clinical trials. It's very risky if that one study manager leaves the organization and moves out or something, then the study is at risk and the drug is at risk. And to minimize that, we built a lot of intelligence into the platform and automation and workflows to speed up the whole process.
Hey, you mentioned something that was new to me, maybe not to all our listeners, but you said you took some lessons from the Steve Blank Startup Manual. And I'm wondering if you could share, you know, the top one or two things you took away from that book and how you put them in practice.
Absolutely, Ken. You know, coming from a technology, engineering, and scientific background myself, the Steve Blank's methodology is a well-established Silicon Valley serial entrepreneur who reduced the success formula for startups into this startup manual, which the National Science Foundation in the United States has adopted as their Bible that they are now propagating through a program called Innovation Core. It's a $50,000 grant that is provided to competitively selected entrepreneurs from science and technology backgrounds. And what the whole Steve Blank methodology teaches is get out of the building, go talk to customers, and validate your assumptions, hypotheses about the problems you are planning to solve, and build the business model canvas, you know, which is a 9-block canvas. One of them is key problems and value propositions. What are the hair on fire problems? You know, hair on fire problem essentially is a problem for which the customer cares so much that they lose their sleep and they think about that and worry about it at night, and that they are willing to take action. They are willing to spend money. They are willing to sacrifice some effort to solve that hair on fire problem. And that's very critical for entrepreneurs to understand and identify very early before actually building the product. Because building a product can take significant investment of time, commitment, and money, not only of the founder, but also many investors. And so before you actually commit to doing that, in 7 weeks, the NSF iCore program encourages founders and entrepreneurial teams to go out, get out of the building, talk to 100 stakeholders, decision makers, influencers, saboteurs, and make a quick go, no-go decision. Is this a business that's worth investing my time and money and somebody else's time and money to build a solution for? Because the solution may work, but then the customer may not be willing to either pay for the product or make the sacrifice of changing from the way they are doing business today to this new way of doing business, because it was not a hair on fire problem to begin with. And so find those very critical problems and value for which can be compelling is basically what Steve Blank's methodology ultimately teaches. It involves talking to people. It's not about sitting in a cubicle and crunching numbers or building a fantastic product because I believe that the idea is great, but because customers told me firsthand and their pupils dilated when they said it, that this is the problem.
Hard to see those pupils dilate over Zoom too, right? In person.
Exactly. So we have had mostly in-person meetings for that reason, but not during the pandemic.
So as I understand it, your go-to-market is through the CROs, right? These contract research organizations.
So we have numerous channels. One is a direct channel to these end customers that we can find at conferences or LinkedIn and warm introductions and different channels to get to the biopharmaceutical clinical trial operations professionals and decision makers. But the research organizations already have a well-established relationships with these customers. And so they can be a very valuable channel to go through and reach large number of customers in a short period of time. And so we are pursuing both, building direct relationships as well as through the partnerships.
What's the risk reward of going through a channel like that? I mean, there must be some risk along with the reward, right?
Absolutely. You know, there is always this risk of getting consumed in a larger organization. We get white labeled, so we may not get brand visibility and awareness. They may take revenue share, which may cut into our margins. So those are some of the disadvantages. And so we have to make those choices based on the one-on-one conversations we have to identify partners. Some of them may even be developing competing products internally, and eventually they may replace our product and so on. So that's another set of risk. And also IP protection is always a risk.
Well, so to build their own thing, I think that sort of puts the pressure on you to always be better than they could do for themselves, and maybe ask them the question, what business are you really in, right?
Exactly. And so that's where we make the time to identify synergistic and ideal partners when they check boxes like that. And that's the kind of partners we love working with in a transparent and a complementary manner, where we value what they bring to the table in terms of disease area and therapeutic area expertise in cancer or rare disease and diabetes and so on, which is very critical. You know, it's ultimately human expertise and ingenuity that will make a clinical trial successful or not. Technology that we offer is an enabler, which will make it efficient and productive. But ultimately, we rely on the partner's expertise to make it successful.
And what are the benefits to the partner for partnering with you? Like, other than the benefit to their sponsors, right, the research sponsor, how does partnering with Jiva benefit the CROs?
The numerous ways, Ken, and the big one is differentiating themselves in this competitive space. You know, ultimately, a contract research organization manages the study, does the site monitoring, sometimes even site selection or protocol design, and executing the full clinical trial, you know, in terms of ensuring compliance, data quality, completeness, that sites are being monitored on a regular basis to identify risks in advance and take preventive action, and executing all the contracts with sites. Sometimes there might be hundreds of investigator sites in a large clinical trial, globally distributed. And so these CROs have feet on the ground in different countries to go and monitor physically. The facilities, are they in good quality, compliant, and so on. So what's in it for them is the key differentiation. There are many CROs like this. And so how do you differentiate yourself? When you have a platform like Jiva, which is developed with empathy, with concern for all the human issues and burden that investigators and CROs go through, having a platform like Jiva helps CROs differentiate themselves in how they can help the sponsors speed up the whole process of clinical development. That's number one. Number two, it also gives them a way to respond to the question, what's your plan to increase diversity in clinical trials? What's your plan to ensure timely patient recruitment and retention? Many of the CROs that we interviewed early on told us that answer to those questions has been a boilerplate paragraphs that they copy and paste in every single proposal. For last 15 years, that paragraph hasn't changed one bit. It's like a, in the press release about us paragraph, it's like a boilerplate. And so what are we going to do better, newer, innovative to increase diversity in clinical trials or help speed up the recruitment and retention? That's what Jiva brings, a refreshing new way and a easy, simple way, which does not expect them to sacrifice much at all. In fact, it's going to decrease their burden, because we heard investigators say that they had to log into 30 different tools to make one clinical trial successful. And so we bring many of those tools under one login, so they don't have to manage 10 different vendors, compliance, data security, privacy in multiple places. It's all in a central database, and users log in into a single portal. Based on their role, they perform activities that they are expected to. And that enables collaboration among these complex stakeholders and actors who have their own jobs to perform.
So I want to move on to another topic. It wasn't actually on our list of topics, but it occurred to me as we're speaking.
Yeah.
You have a pretty technical background, but was building software in your own bag of tricks?
Absolutely. My undergrad was a computer science engineering major. And during my grad school, master's in computer science with bioinformatics specialization, I did a summer internship at Microsoft, where also I was a part of a complex team at building complex software programming. And then my first job after PhD and during PhD involved developing simulation models, you know, analyzing genome sequencing data, writing algorithms and data integration and so on. So yes, absolutely, software programming, data integration, analytics, that's my technical scientific expertise.
So you had a unique advantage in founding a software company. Well, how much of this development started with you? And then how did you build out your team?
So interestingly, I have not written a single line of code, Ken, until now. I like to keep it that way, because where I see the biggest value that I bring to this industry is as an interdisciplinary scientist, engineer, and an entrepreneur who comes with very deep care for people, problems, and a personal motivation to help address a fundamental access issue and inequity issue in enabling. So that's where my strength lies, in feeling the pain of the other person and different people who have to work together, considering their own pains and gains towards a common goal of bringing new drugs to market faster, cheaper, and better. And so I focus on the what and the why. The how part, which is the development of the code and the development itself, I have outsourced. And as a startup raising investor capital, I have leveraged an outsourced partner who does 50% of the development for cash payments and 50% of the development for equity warrants. So, for example, $1 million software development resources that I have utilized, I had to pay $500,000, and the other $500,000 was an equity warrant that I issued for them in the company. And that's with a partner called KiwiTech. It's a public partnership that has been announced since the beginning in 2000. And that's the team, you know, and I have hired a in-house product manager slash engineer who is a deep techie, coming from the top institutions in India, like Indian Institute of Technology with a BTech, MTech in biotechnology, with 15 years of experience building cloud native applications, and a recent master's in computer science graduate from New York University in Binghamton has been onboarded. He did a good job as a summer intern last year and then ended up hiring him. But the core development team is based out of New Delhi, through our partner KiwiTech, which did much of the development.
And is that a common development approach to partner that way?
It is increasingly getting more common in de-risking, having to build a full-time team, staff members, you know, because we need back-end developers, front-end developers, HTML design, software testing and QA, business analysts and project manager, architecture. So, you know, for startups to have a team of 10 people who can do all these functions is just a lot of fixed cost, and they may or may not work out. And so having a team with a partner and identifying a good partner is no easy task in itself. But if you are fortunate enough and smart enough to make the right choice and have the right partner, it significantly de-risks, because now you can always seek a better resource. If you are not happy with a backend developer, you can ask for a different resource and your cost will remain the same.
Did you have any help constructing that agreement? Like, did your sources of funding help you with that? Like, how did you arrive at that agreement? Because it's the first time I've heard it. I'm sure it's not that uncommon, but I think we might as well, to the extent you're comfortable, you know, look behind the curtain of that kind of agreement.
Absolutely. You know, some of this might be proprietary or confidential to the partner. It might be their trade secret. So I won't go into the details of that agreement, but essentially, net-net, we worked with Cooley as our law firm, who reviewed the standard agreement template that the partner had, and it was their business model. So we did not have to change anything. That's how they have helped maybe 300 or 400 different startups in their last several years. And they also have a startup ecosystem. And so they built this agreement template or standard. I got it reviewed, and there were a few back and forth about two or three times. And back when we had zero revenue and limited investment, doing three iterations on that agreement with a large law firm like Cooley was expensive, but it was very necessary, you know, because we had to start off with a very strong footing. Main thing was, you know, competition and IP. You know, we had to clearly own 100% of the IP and branding and control over the product. As long as we pay them their dues, we own the product 100%. And that was the most critical aspect of that negotiation. But other than that...
What's the name of the development firm again?
It's called KiwiTech LLC. It's based out of Washington, D.C. And they have their teams in India and other countries. They have a team of about 500 engineers.
Hey, before we land the episode, my last question, and it's my new favorite question. What's the one big mistake you made and what you do differently now looking back?
I've made numerous mistakes. I'm wondering which one to mention, but maybe I'll mention a couple. You know, one is starting off solo. You know, I'm a single founder startup and I have survived 4 years of carrying the huge responsibility of the every dollar that I have received as investment and support from numerous angels and family investors, and now increasingly institutional investors. And so having co-founders, at least one or two more founders, would really be valuable if you can find ones that you think you can spend another 5 years of your life, every single day and night, who you can hang out with. That would significantly make the journey a lot less painful. That's one, I wouldn't call it a mistake, but if I could go back and change, that's one thing I would look to change, is have co-founders. And two, quitting my full-time job too soon, you know, when all I had was an idea and I wanted to start, I thought I'll quit my job and start building the product. And so that's why I quit my job. And soon I realized it's not that simple and it would be a big mistake to start building the product immediately. And I was guided to do customer discovery, at least several hundred customers before you feel confident that building a product is the right approach and it's worthwhile, and that what you're building is actually going to be accepted by the industry. And so quitting my job too soon was in some ways a mistake, but given that it has resulted in these many interviews which guided the whole process, and I have been working overtime, right, from day one, even when it took us 14 months before we started developing the product, I was completely occupied, busy, and fully involved in the startup process. And so it did hurt me financially and my family in some ways in the early days. I could have been getting some good paycheck while I did the customer discovery. But then doing 15 interviews per week, even with full-time commitment, was not easy. So I don't know how I could have done it differently anyway. But people tell me, experienced industry serial entrepreneurs told me that I quit my job too soon.
Fair enough. Well, I think that's a great place to land the episode. And if people want to learn more about your company and get in touch with you, how can they do that?
I should be relatively easy to find on LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, but also our company website is www.jeevatrials.com. That's J-E-E-V-A trials.com. And my name, Harsha, or CEO, at jeevatrials.com would be a good email to reach me at.
Awesome. Thank you. And if people want to reach me, I'm on LinkedIn/in/KenLempit. My company website is austinlawrence.com. That's Lawrence with a W. And if you haven't yet subscribed to the podcast, please do so wherever podcasts are distributed. Thanks so much, Harsha. That was an awesome interview. Have a great day and good luck with Jeeva Informatics.
Thank you so much for having me, Ken. It was my pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the SaaS Backwards Podcast, brought to you by Austin Lawrence Group. We're a growth marketing agency that helps SaaS firms reduce churn, accelerate sales, and generate demand. Learn more about us at www.austinlawrence.com. You can email Ken Lempit at kl@austinlawrence.com about any SaaS marketing or customer retention subject. We hope you'll subscribe. And thanks again for listening.